extremely feasible. But in 1926, Kahn learned that Moses intended to run the parkway right through the middle of the 18-hole private golf course he had constructed for his pleasure on his Cold Spring Harbor estate. Kahn, who happened to be a relative of Moses, he was married to the daughter of one of Bella's sisters, offered to secretly donate $10,000 to the Park Commission for surveys if some of the surveys found a new route for the parkway in the Cold Spring Harbor area, a route which would not cross his estate at all. And Moses accepted the money. Regard for power implies disregard for those without power, as is demonstrated by what happened after Moses shifted the route of the Northern State Parkway away from Otto Kahn's golf course. The map of the Northern State Parkway in Cold Spring Harbor is a map not only of a road, but of power, and of what happens to those who, unwittingly, are caught in the path of power. The parkway was originally supposed to run through Otto Kahn's estate. Since Otto Kahn had power, the power that went with money, he was able to get the route shifted to the south. South of Otto Kahn's estate lay the estates of two other men of wealth and of influence with the legislature, Congressman Ogden Livingston Mills and Colonel Henry Rogers Winthrop. The congressman and the colonel were able to get the route shifted farther south, far enough so it would not touch their estates either. But shifting the route south of the Mills and Winthrop estates meant that it would run through the estates of two other men of wealth and influence, Colonel Henry L. Stimson and Robert W. DeForest. So the route was shifted south again, and south of the Stimson and DeForest estates lay a row of farms, and farmers had neither wealth nor influence. James Roth was one of those farmers. When he had purchased his 49 acres in 1922, much of it had been woodland, and all of it had been rocky. Roth had hauled away the rocks and cut down the trees. He owned a team of horses, but they could not budge many of the stumps. As the horses pulled at them, Roth pulled beside them. So did his wife Helen. So that both would be freed for the pulling, their son Jimmy, at the age of 5, had to learn how to handle the team. As his parents sweated at the ropes, he sat on one of the horses, kicking him forward. After the farm was cleared, the Roths found that the southern 15 acres were no good for planting, but the rest of the land was rich and fertile. In the afternoons, during harvest season, James Roth, who had been up since before dawn working in the fields, would load up one of his two wagons and drive to market. While he was gone, his wife and son, who in 1927 was 6, would load the other. When Roth returned, he would, without pause, since every minute was important to a farmer trying to work 34 acres without a hired man, unharness the team, hitch it to the loaded wagon, and begin the trip again, while Helen and Jimmy would reload the first wagon. But by 1927, the farm had begun paying. "We felt pretty secure," Jimmy recalls. "We had a nice farm. In those days, a farm wasn't just real estate like it is now. In those days, a farm was your living. It was your home. And we had a nice farm." Then, in 1927, a representative of the Long Island State Park Commission, of Robert Moses, drove up to the Roths' farm and told them the state was condemning 14 acres out of the farm's center for the Northern State Parkway. James Roth argued with Moses' representative. He pleaded with him. All he wanted the commission to do, Roth said, was to move the parkway route about 400 feet south, less than a tenth of a mile. That would put it in the barren part of the farm. Taking 14 acres from the center meant that a substantial part of the fertile acreage would be gone. Even more important, it meant that the farm would be sliced in two. How would he get from one side to the other? How would he be able to work it? But Moses' representative refused to listen to the Roths. The route had been decided on the basis of engineering considerations, he said. It could not possibly be changed. Robert Moses had shifted the parkway south of Otto Kahn's estate, south of Winthrop's and Mills' estates, south of Stimson's and DeForest's. For men of wealth and influence, he had moved it more than 3 miles south of its original location. But James Roth possessed neither money nor influence. And for James Roth, Robert Moses would not move the Parkway South even one-tenth of a mile farther. For James Roth, Robert Moses would not move the Parkway 1 foot. Robert Moses had offered men of wealth and influence bridges across the Parkway so that there would be no interference with their pleasures, but he wouldn't offer James Roth a bridge so that there would be no interference with his planting. In years to come, James Roth would talk often about the injustice that had been done to him. My father was really rocked by this. He talked about it until the end of his life, says his son Jimmy, who had watched his father and mother sweating side by side over their land. And I don't know that I blame him. I'll tell you, my father and mother worked very hard on that place and made something out of it, and then someone just cut it in two. To have someone take away something you have... The farm never really paid again. There just wasn't enough fertile acreage left, and the Roths found that it took fully 25 minutes to drive their team to the nearest road that crossed the Parkway and then to get back to plow the other side of the farm. Each round trip took about 50 minutes, and these were 50-minute segments slashed out of the life of a man to whom every minute was necessary. It was quite a ways, Mrs. Roth recalls. It was quite a ways for a man who was working hard already. The condemnation award never came to much, Mrs. Roth says. And because there were two separate, rather small pieces of property instead of a single big one, she says, they couldn't even sell the farm. The situation was the same for the other Cold Spring Harbor farmers whose farms were ruined by the Northern State Parkway. To the end of their lives, most of them would remember the day on which they heard that the road was coming as a day of tragedy. There was only one aspect of the tragedy that alleviated their bitterness. That was their belief that it was unavoidable, that the route of the Parkway had indeed been determined by engineering considerations and therefore really could not be changed. 40 years later, when the author asked them about the possibility of the Parkway being built through the big estates to the north, not one of those farmers thought that such a possibility had ever existed. Moses was given a further increase in power as a result of Smith's bid for the presidency in 1928. No associate of the governor was more enthusiastic about the bid than Moses. On the June night when the Democratic Party was balloting at its convention in Houston and the executive mansion in Albany was overflowing with reporters, well-wishers, and hangers-on, the porches and the grounds outside filled with throngs, Moses was one of the handful who were invited to join the Smith family in the big second-floor room in which the governor was trying to listen to the balloting over the static. When Ohio's votes gave Smith the nomination, and Emily Smith ran to her father and threw her arms around his neck, it was to Moses that Belle Moskowitz turned and said, almost crying, "Bob, it's over." And other people in the room were to say that they had never seen Moses happier than at that moment. Belle's remark was, after all, understandable. Al Smith had run in 22 elections, and he had won 21. And in the one he had lost, he ran almost 1 million votes ahead of his ticket. She, and Moses and the other members of the Smith inner circle in the room with the governor, didn't see how he could lose. Al Smith got up from the big armchair in which he had sat for hours, his attention on the radio, motionless except for the grinding of his lips against his big cigar and the stroking of one hand on the neck of his Great Dane, Jeff, walked over to a small bar, grabbed 2 handfuls of ice cubes, began dropping them into glasses, and said, "Now all of yous, come aboard." But Moses did not play a major role in the Smith presidential campaign. The governor had long since stopped using him as a speech drafter. He had great respect for Bob's viewpoint on everything except speeches, Howard Coleman says. The governor said Bob would just murder him on those. He said Bob had no idea of the public pulse on most issues. And the campaign was run by Mrs. Moskowitz and by a group of wealthy Irish Catholics who had recently become close to Smith. So Moses was spared being with his Gamaliel when he went down to defeat in what Oscar Handlin has called a dark episode in American history. He wasn't with him when, on his tours of a south and a west that he hardly knew, Smith realized that the gay renditions of the sidewalks of New York were being drowned out by whispers that were the surface hissing of what Handlin has called the dark secret prejudice against the urban foreigners, including Catholics, held in subservience to a foreign despot by an army of priests and bishops. Moses never saw the fiery crosses that burned on the hills of Kansas and Oklahoma, and on the Shinnecock Hills of Suffolk County, as Smith's campaign train passed. Moses wasn't on the train when the realization spread through it that the prejudice and intolerance could not be licked, and that even if it could, 1928, with the Hoover market booming and the nation prosperous and complacent, just wasn't a Democratic year. Moses' contribution to the Smith campaign was twofold. First, his accomplishments provided the ammunition for the most successful of Smith's speeches, those which concentrated on his record as governor. Second, while Smith was campaigning, Moses ran the state for him. This was no minor task. Voters in 1928 were far less tolerant than those in 1974 are about officeholders neglecting their duties to seek higher office, and Smith realized that the Republican legislators would take full advantage of any opportunity to charge him with laxness. To make sure that there was no opportunity, Smith gave Moses full authority over all state departments during the months he spent on the campaign trail. He even told Moses to use his office and sit in his big chair in the executive chamber. Moses did so. He presided over the drawing up of the 1929 state budget, the first in the state's history to be drawn up under his executive budget plan. He handled the governor's mail, screening it for important letters that should be sent on to him, and making sure that he never saw the obscene threats that terrified Smith's wife, Katie, when she read them. While Smith was campaigning, Moses ran New York, and the measure of his success in the job was that there wasn't a single Republican charge of laxness in that period. Moses had no opportunity to take pleasure from either his power or his success as Smith's surrogate. Time, which had for so long panted hungrily at his heels, had drawn close enough to nip them now. Smith had been prevented by law from running for governor at the same time he was running for president, and while a new governor could not oust Moses as Long Island Park Commission head, his six-year term, after all, did not expire until 1930, he could effectively kill any of his park projects that were not well underway when he was inaugurated. And while Moses had accomplished so much during his 4 years in office, the accomplishments were as nothing beside his dreams. There was, in 1928, so much yet to do. Although his entire right-of-way for the Southern State Parkway had been acquired and construction started on much of it, not a single section had been completed. Without that section, the public would not see how great it was going to be and would not be ready to support him against any governor who tried to keep him from completing it up to the same, expensive standards. The Wantagh Causeway to Jones Beach was not completed, and since the public could not see the strand, how could it know he was justified in the expenditure of whatever millions were needed to make it the greatest bathing beach in the world? The Northern State Parkway was not even begun. Unless he could announce that a substantial portion of the right-of-way had been acquired, how could he force a new governor into building the road? So, in November and December of 1928, construction crews were out on the Southern State and the Wantagh, and the surveyors were out along the route of the Northern State. Those close to Robert Moses knew there was justification for his urgency, a reason for the desperation which now seemed to underlie his haste. "Without his loyalty to me," Moses was to say about Al Smith, "I could have done nothing." He had had Al Smith and his loyalty for 10 years, but now he was to have Al Smith no more, and the man who was to follow Moses' greatest friend into the governor's chair was Moses' deadliest enemy. Chapter 16. The Feather Duster. There is an expression used in Albany to describe the relationship of two men between whom there exists bad feeling. When that feeling has existed for years, has resisted every attempt at reconciliation, and has only deepened with the passage of time, to a point where dislike is not so fitting a name for it as hatred. In discussing two such men, one assemblyman will say to another, with a knowing shake of his head, "They go back a long way." Robert Moses and Franklin Delano Roosevelt went back a very long way. Roosevelt's relationship with the whole circle of advisors around Al Smith was an ambivalent one. They needed him, and they knew it. Any Irish Catholic, city-bred, militantly wet Tammany politician, even an Al Smith, needed help with the Protestant, farm-bred, militantly dry, Tammany-hating upstate New York farmers. Upstate Democrats of stature were in short supply. In fact, Roosevelt was the only one. And you could hardly ask for a better ally. The tall, handsome, aristocratic Groton and Harvard graduate, who looked exactly like the Hudson River squire he was, had won upstate acceptance of his anti-Tammany bona fides in 1911, during his first state Senate term, by rallying a band of young colleagues and leading them to victory in what had seemed a hopeless cause, their fight against the selection for a vacant United States Senate seat of silent Charlie Murphy's candidate, railroad frontman William F. Blue-Eyed Billy Sheehan. Until 1913, United States senators were selected by state legislatures. Thereafter, upstaters were willing to listen to Roosevelt when he told them, as he did at countless county fairs, that farmers like you and I should support Smith because the governor had risen above the Tammany background from which he had sprung. If, moreover, Smith had ambitions that went beyond New York State, and he did, he needed an emissary to the Democratic Party's rural, dry Protestant wing. And young Franklin bore a name which, throughout the country, possessed the magic that a half-century later would infuse the name Kennedy. More than one newspaper, praising his performance as the 1920 Democratic vice presidential nominee, and noting that he had followed Cousin Teddy into the New York legislature and an assistant secretaryship of the Navy, had commented that if T.R.'s sons proved unable to carry the old Rough Rider's banner back up the steps of the White House, there was another member of the family who might do it for them. His every intervention on Smith's behalf had been immensely helpful. Striding, athletic and graceful, to the speaker's podium at the 1920 Democratic National Convention, he had seconded the governor's token presidential nomination in an effective speech. In July 1922, with Smith out of office, taking his evening walks home with Moses, Roosevelt, crippled now, got Smith's gubernatorial candidacy off the ground with an open letter calling on him to run. Floor manager for Smith at the 1924 National Convention, he had been his nominator too, swinging to the platform on crutches and delivering a speech that, using a phrase from Wordsworth, dubbed the governor the happy warrior of the political battlefield, a speech that historian Mark Sullivan called a noble utterance. Among Smith's happier moments during the convention's interminable 103 ballots were Roosevelt's appearances at the microphone to rally his supporters. So enthusiastic a Smith supporter was he that when the governor ran in 1926 against Theodore Roosevelt Jr., the new Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and Franklin Roosevelt found himself physically unable to campaign against his cousin, he sent his wife to do it. To remind voters of Theodore Jr.'s connection, peripheral at worst, with the Teapot Dome oil scandal, Eleanor Roosevelt constructed a huge cardboard cutout of a teapot blowing steam, tied it on the top of a car, and with it trailed her cousin-in-law around the state, a maneuver which she later ruefully admitted had been a rough stunt. But Roosevelt was never really part of the Smith inner circle. As Oscar Handlin put it, he had been brought up in an atmosphere that stressed the compulsive understatement. It was inevitable that he should feel awkward in Smith's suite at the Biltmore. All those people. He may never actually have dined at the Tiger Room, but he must have heard stories of the goings-on. He could not, without denying his own background, fail to disapprove of the kinds of people Al and his friends were. And yet, as Handlin added, mingled with the disapproval was a touch of envy at being left out of the fun. Roosevelt obviously wished he had Moses' gift for blending in easily with the governor and his hard-drinking, hard-talking friends. Wanting to be part of the Biltmore scene, feeling awkward about going there alone, Roosevelt would, in 1923, often telephone Moses in the late afternoon from his office at 120 Broadway and ask if he might stop by, pick him up, and go along to the hotel with him. Moses took Roosevelt along, but the latter's appearances at the Biltmore were always touched with restraint. Smith appreciated Roosevelt's help and felt a genuine affection for him and Eleanor. Shy about his lack of grammar, the governor almost never wrote personal letters, but he wrote many to the Roosevelts after Campobello, short, gruff notes full of sympathy and cheer. But, despite the governor's efforts to erase it, the line between the Fourth Ward contract executor and the Ivy Leaguer, the line which Moses had so thoroughly erased in his own case, always remained drawn between Smith and Roosevelt. Once, with regret in his voice, Smith told a friend, "Franklin just isn't the kind of man you can take into the piss room and talk intimately with." Furthermore, Smith and his circle had something less than respect for Roosevelt's abilities. This attitude was understandable. Roosevelt's Harvard classmates had felt the same way. Mocking his propensity for hopping into and out of different interests in quick and shallow succession, they called him the Feather Duster. After college, because of the same propensity, Roosevelt had not been a particularly successful lawyer or businessman. An acquaintance would recall that when, at the age of 28, he decided to enter politics, running for state senator from Dutchess County, everybody called him Franklin and regarded him as a harmless bust. In Albany, his haughty manner, accentuated by his habit of throwing up his head so as to give the appearance of looking down his nose, his pince-nez, all this, combined with his leadership in the anti-Sheehan fight, stamped him as a snob and branded his ideas, in the outraged language of one regular Democrat, as the silly conceits of a political prig. Francis Perkins was to remember him arguing with two or three colleagues, his small mouth pursed up, saying, "No, no, I won't hear of it." Tammany's Big Tim Sullivan was only summing up the prevailing opinion in Albany when he said, "Awful arrogant fellow, that Roosevelt." Moreover, as Handlin notes, to the hard, shrewd men around the governor, who had clawed their way up through a tough world and who knew the state government in detail, Roosevelt, with his airy plans, his many hobbies, and his glittering, sweeping discourses, seemed a hopelessly impractical intellectual. For some reason, Smith's advisors overlooked the fact that not silent Charlie Murphy, but the political prig, had been the winner of the Sheehan fight. And, after his polio attack in 1921, they did not seem to consider what it had taken for Roosevelt to decide to go back into politics at a time when, Eleanor Roosevelt was later to recall, he was lying in bed and working for hours to try to wiggle one toe. Roosevelt's head had always been tilted at that gay, confident angle. They didn't seem to think of the strength that had had to be found somewhere to keep it tilted now. The agonizing steps he had taken to the podium to give his happy warrior speech were the manifestation of an indomitable spirit, but Smith's intimates never thought of the speech without giggling over what had preceded it. The story as they knew it would be somewhat different from that recounted by historians, or by Dory Sherry, who in Sunrise at Campobello portrayed FDR as saying, when Smith asked him to let Joseph Proskauer help write the speech, "I won't mind the addition of a few phrases, but Al, what I say will have to be what I want to say." Actually, when Smith and Proskauer walked into Roosevelt's office at Smith campaign headquarters and asked him to make the nominating speech, Roosevelt replied, "I'd like to, but I'm so busy with the delegates. Joe, will you write me a speech?" I had already written a speech, the Happy Warrior speech, Proskauer would tell the author. I waited a few days and then sent it to him. He asked me to come in and talk about it. He said, Joe, I can't make that speech. It's too poetic. You can't quote a Wordsworth poem to a bunch of politicians. Proskauer told the author, and so did Smith's daughter Emily and two other Smith intimates, that he kept insisting on retaining the Happy Warrior line, while Roosevelt kept insisting that it be removed. Otherwise, Roosevelt said, he would refuse to give the speech. Roosevelt even wrote a speech of his own. Finally, Proskauer recalled, I said, why didn't we get a third person to come and take a look and try to reconcile the two speeches? I said, I was thinking of Herbert Bayard Swope. He said, fine. That night, we went to Frank's apartment. Swope made a faux pas. We hadn't told him who had written them, and he read Frank's speech first, threw it on the floor, and said, Joe, this is the goddamnest, rottenest speech I've ever read. Then he read mine, and he said, this is the greatest speech since Bragg nominated Cleveland. Roosevelt continued to argue and to say he refused to give my speech. Finally, about midnight, I got up and said, Frank, we're all exhausted. I have just enough authority from the governor to tell you you'll either make that speech or none at all. And he said, oh, I'll make the goddamn speech, and it'll be a flop. The laughter which boomed out at the Tiger Room or the Biltmore Suite when Swope or Proskauer repeated the story, and they repeated it often, helped to blind the men sitting in those jovial watering holes to developing traits in Roosevelt's character. And more important, it blinded them also to the fact that, while he was completely loyal to Smith, he was using his position as a campaigner for a presidential candidate to keep in touch with key Democrats across the country in preparation for a presidential bid of his own. They never guessed that he even had a timetable, a run for the governorship in 1932 and the presidency in 1936. As one Roosevelt biographer put it, the Smith advisors regarded their acquisition as no more than a showy but harmless piece of window dressing. All the advisors, that is, except one. Sitting off in a corner of the Biltmore suite, away from the laughter, Belle Moskowitz, who had seen in the 30-year-old failure Robert Moses something no one else had seen, was watching harmless Franklin Roosevelt. And by 1924, she had come to the conclusion that he was a threat, a very dangerous threat, to her dream that Alfred E. Smith would one day sit in the White House. The other advisors didn't take this view seriously. For once, they said, Mrs. M. was wrong. In 1924, when Smith appointed Moses president of the Long Island State Park Commission, the governor appointed Roosevelt chairman of the Taconic State Park Commission. The thin veneer of friendliness between Moses and Roosevelt thereupon flaked off abruptly and completely. Moses would attribute the break to a single incident revolving around gnarled, emaciated little Lewis M. Howe, Roosevelt's devoted advisor, whom Smith's circle, because of his habitually dirty, sweat-stained collars and suits dotted with food stains and flecked with cigarette ashes, called Lousy Louie. When Roosevelt attempted to appoint Howe secretary of the Taconic Commission, Moses stepped in. If Roosevelt wanted a secretary and valet, he said, he would have to pay him himself. Getting Howe the secretary's job, which paid $5,000 per year, was important to Roosevelt. Unable to move around freely, he knew that he would be able to remain in politics only if he was able to delegate most of the tasks he had formerly performed himself. He therefore needed an organization, even if it was only two or three secretaries, but he had to have Howe to direct them and to represent him at political meetings he himself could no longer attend, and he was not financially able to pay Howe an adequate salary. Howe had been about to accept a lucrative offer from private industry when Roosevelt was stricken, but as soon as he had learned of the tragedy at Campobello, he had declined the job. Roosevelt had to find a place for him on some governmental payroll, and the only governmental body on which Roosevelt held an official position in 1924 was the Taconic Commission. But Moses was adamant. the State Parks Council would veto any salary for Howe as secretary, he said. Moses was always to contend that the bad blood between him and Roosevelt flowed from this single incident. Howe never forgave him for the valet insult, he said, and took every opportunity to poison Roosevelt's mind against him. You see, Moses would tell the author, Roosevelt was in such terrible physical shape that he was home at night a lot, and a person in that kind of condition is very susceptible to the people who were there with him in that house all night. And Howe was always there, and Roosevelt would listen to his stories. It was the result of his illness. He was susceptible to that kind of thing. But the feeling between Moses and Roosevelt burned too deep to be attributable to a single incident. Personality may have had something to do with it. Moses, after all, was not the only one of the two men whom Albany had found arrogant. Moses was not the only one of the two men who had been given a sip of power, who had liked the taste, and who wanted more. And much of the feeling was certainly due to the fact that during the early 1920s, Moses was not the only one of the two men dreaming about parks and parkways. During the same years that Robert Moses was tramping the hills and beaches of Long Island, envisioning great parks and parkways there, Franklin Roosevelt was tramping, in his imagination, the hills and rolling farmland of his native Dutchess County, envisioning great parks and parkways there. His ideas were on a scale as big as Moses, and in the park system that Moses was building, there was room for only one man with big ideas. Roosevelt had been interested in parks long before Moses, in fact, both because of his own preoccupations and because of his interest in his famous cousin's campaign to conserve natural resources. He had, from childhood, cared deeply about nature, about land, water, and trees. For years, he had been planting yellow poplar and white pine seedlings by the thousands at the Roosevelt Mansion at Hyde Park. Concerned about the destruction of New York's great forests by lumber companies, he proposed in 1922 the formation of a syndicate that would purchase a tract within 100 miles of New York City and operate it as a park, as private interests operated forests for recreation in Europe. If Moses knew Long Island as few men knew it, Roosevelt could, in the days when he could walk, say the same thing about Dutchess County and about the other three counties, Putnam, Columbia, and Rensselaer, whose gently rolling hills made with Dutchess a continuous soft green border, broken only by the patchwork of cultivated fields all along the east bank of the Hudson from Westchester to Albany. He had long had his eye on particularly beautiful tracts, which he wanted preserved from commercial exploitation. He had, in fact, been negotiating on behalf of the Boy Scouts for one in Putnam County. He was especially enthusiastic about a plan to have New York build a tri-state park, in cooperation with Massachusetts and Connecticut, at the juncture of those three states. The Bronx River Parkway, just opened in Westchester County and a wonder of the world, was pointing at the Taconic region. Even before he was appointed to the Taconic Commission, Roosevelt had envisioned joining to the Bronx River Parkway a new parkway that would head straight north through the Taconic farm counties to parks that could be created there, thereby opening up the lovely Hudson Valley. The parkway as he envisioned it would eventually extend all the way to Albany, and thus make accessible to New York City the beauties of the Adirondack, Berkshire, and White Mountains. When Smith and Moses, badly needing his name in the Taylor estate fight, offered Roosevelt the chairmanship of the Taconic Park Commission, whose jurisdiction would encompass the whole east bank of the Hudson from Westchester to Albany, Roosevelt asked if he would be able to build the parkway. Moses apparently gave him assurances on the point. Roosevelt was later to remind Smith that he had, and Roosevelt eagerly accepted. Within months, he had old Clarence Fahnestock primed to donate his 6,169 acres at Lake Oskawana as a state park, and he had completed arrangements for the transfer of three smaller tracts farther north. Having himself driven around the countryside, he had selected sites for small camping parks that he wanted built along the parkway. He was sketching himself picnic tables and fireplaces, and thinking about which type of rock should be used to face bridges over the parkway so that it would blend in most naturally with the landscape. Roosevelt was impatient to get this splendid project underway. The price of the land for the Boy Scout camp had risen 30% in the 2 years he was negotiating for it. He was driven, as was Moses, by the knowledge that soaring land values were making land acquisition continually more difficult. The securing of the rights of way for the state should, he wrote, be immediately put through. But there was insufficient money in the park allocations made by the legislature even for Moses' Long Island park plan, and he didn't want any spent on a 125-mile parkway somewhere else. And, it may be, he didn't want within the park system he was so assiduously welding into a monolithic entity, responsive solely to his command, any opening wedges driven for a project that would be under the command of another vigorous, independent man. Repeatedly, Moses State Parks Council slashed Roosevelt's budget requests to a level insufficient even to begin acquiring right-of-way for a parkway. The money allowed was not sufficient even for the Taconic Commission to hire an adequate executive staff, and Roosevelt charged that the lack of staff prevented the commission from making plans that would allow it to spend, on small parks, even the meager amount of money it was allotted. In addition, Moses now said a Taconic Parkway should not extend north to Albany, but should end only a few miles north of New York City. Matters came to a head in November 1926. In submitting during that month his budget request for 1927, Roosevelt asked for funds for engineering plans for the Taconic Parkway, for right-of-way surveys, and for salaries for an adequate staff, including Lewis Howe. When the State Parks Council met to consider the Regional Commission's budget requests, Roosevelt was in Warm Springs, Georgia, where he went every winter to try to coax his dead legs back to life. It disapproved those of the Taconic Commission, on the grounds that it had not spent all the money allocated to it in the past. Returning north, Roosevelt had at least one bitter face-to-face confrontation with Moses, the details of which can only be imagined. Then, Roosevelt tried to go over Moses' head. In December 1926, he wrote Smith, asking the governor to restore the funds he had requested. "It is an absurd and humiliating position to be in, to be informed that we could have no money because through lack of an executive we have not been able to properly expend the money we had, and then to be informed that we cannot have an executive because we have not been given more money," he wrote. But Smith was taking Moses' word as to what was happening in park matters. He asked Moses about the Taconic situation, and Moses wrote Smith, "I suggest you write him, Roosevelt, a letter along the line attached." The attached said that of course the parkway would go through, it did not say through to where, but that there was so much competition for the limited money available that it must be concentrated on those projects which were moving ahead fastest, and the Taconic Parkway was not one of those. In fact, the attached said, practically none of the money already allocated to the Taconic Commission had been spent. Smith sent the letter to Roosevelt exactly as Moses had written it. A year later, the State Parks Council eliminated from the Taconic Commission's request all funds except those needed for bare maintenance of existing parks. Roosevelt wrote Smith that, "The other members of the Commission and I feel very strongly that the elimination ends the necessity for the usefulness of the Commission. We have practically no function left." "Moses simply used us," Roosevelt said. "The enormous appropriations for Long Island, while perhaps necessary, prove merely that we have been completely useful to other people. And we won't be used any more. Unless something is done, the commissioners do not feel it is worthwhile to continue." This was serious. There was a presidential election coming up, and Smith needed Roosevelt. In fact, he wanted Roosevelt to nominate him again. He apparently intervened. The commission's operating funds were increased, and Roosevelt was assured, apparently by Moses, that when the Parks Council submitted to the Smith-Hewitt-Hutchinson Committee requests for additional allocations out of a new $10 million park bond issue that had been passed in 1927, it would ask for $200,000 for Taconic Parkway right-of-way. But when the three-man committee met on January 23, 1928, and approved all regional allocations except one, that one was the Taconic. On January 30, 1928, Roosevelt wrote Smith a letter that was as revealing in the depth of the bitterness it displayed toward Moses as it was remarkable, coming as it did from the pen of the man who would later shepherd his country through depression and war. "I wasn't born yesterday," Franklin D. Roosevelt wrote the governor. "You see, I have been in the game so long that I now realize the mistake I made with this Taconic State Park Commission was in not playing the kind of politics that our friend Bob Moses used. You know just as well as I do that Bob has skinned us alive this year, has worked things so beautifully that his baby on Long Island is plentifully taken care of, and that all the other park commissions upstate, except ours, are getting practically what was approved by the State Council of Parks." When the State Council of Parks approved appropriations to the Taconic State Park Commission of nearly $200,000, Bob knew perfectly well that it would not go through, and had his tongue in his cheek when he tried to tell us that he was trying to get it through. As a matter of practical fact, I am very certain in my own mind that we could have got at least some appropriation for acquisition of land this year if Bob and you had gone after it. The money is there, within the total of the budget. For instance, Bob told me himself the other day that on the contract for the New York State office building, a couple of $100,000 will be saved. As parkmen like Ansley Wilcox and Judge Clearwater had charged before him, Roosevelt charged that Moses had lied about him to Smith when he was not around to refute the lies. "I am sorry to say it is a fact that Bob Moses has played fast and loose with the Taconic State Park Commission since the beginning," Roosevelt wrote. "I give him great credit for many accomplishments and for his fine vision of a complete state park system, but he has been guilty of making so many false statements about the Taconic State Park Commission, which I have checked up and know all about, that I am very certain that you have been given a very erroneous lot of information about the commission." As Wilcox and Clearwater had charged before him, Roosevelt charged that Moses had lied about him to the other members of the Parks Council when he was not around to refute the lies. "One example is sufficient," he wrote. "Bob told the State Council of Parks that the Taconic State Park Commission had done nothing to cooperate with Massachusetts and Connecticut authorities. As a matter of fact, we have not only cooperated with them from the beginning, but are in close touch with them at all times, and can tell you or him at any moment just what the situation is in both those states." "Moses will have a chance to lie about me no more," Roosevelt said. "The commissioners do not want to be the first to make a break in your splendid statewide park program, but they have been put in a position where I do not see that they can in any decency do anything but resign." Al Smith, who so seldom wrote personal letters, now sat down and wrote one to Franklin D. Roosevelt. "I know of no man I have met in my whole public career who I have any stronger affection for than for yourself," he wrote. "Therefore, you can find as much fault with me as you like. I will not get into a fight with you for anything or for anybody." The letter had its effect. Roosevelt did not resign. But the letter did not change the Taconic Parkway situation or the Moses Roosevelt situation. At the 1928 Democratic Convention, Roosevelt was again Smith's floor manager. Observers noted that at times during his nominating speech, the cheering seemed to be as much for him as for Smith, and there were some suggestions that Roosevelt, a bearer of Teddy Roosevelt's name, a Protestant, and an attractive vice presidential candidate even in defeat in 1920, would make a better presidential candidate than the governor. Bell Moskowitz's comments about Roosevelt began to be more caustic. But Smith himself felt the cheers were no more than Roosevelt deserved, and in September the governor asked Roosevelt to be his successor in Albany. Moses had argued against the choice. There are indications that he half expected Smith to name him instead, to try to force him on the Democratic Party. Although he had always identified himself as an independent Republican when reporters asked him his political affiliation, he quietly enrolled as a Democrat when he registered to vote in 1928, a bit of opportunism that did him no good, since his name was never seriously mentioned for the governorship that year by Smith or anyone else. Moreover, among those men whose names were seriously considered, Roosevelt was the one Moses least wanted to get the post. He told the conclaves of Democratic leaders to which Smith brought him that Roosevelt did not possess either the mental capacity or the application to be governor. To Francis Perkins, he said that Roosevelt's only asset was a smile. "It's a pity to have him, and that Al has his heart set on him," he told her. "It's undoubtedly a good name to carry the ticket with, but of course he isn't quite bright." The other Smith aides agreed with this view, but mental capacity was not as important to them as political realities. With rum, Romanism, and Tammany rapidly becoming the overriding issue of the presidential campaign, they feared that only Roosevelt's name on the ticket could keep New York's upstate Protestant dries from stampeding into the Republican camp and denying Smith the 45 electoral votes of his own state. Estimating that Roosevelt was a full 200,000 votes stronger than any other candidate, they felt that he was the only man with a chance to defeat the attractive GOP gubernatorial nominee, Attorney General Albert Ottinger. As for his ability, Smith's advisors felt he didn't need much. They felt that Moses' reorganization had so streamlined the state government that Roosevelt's lack of administrative experience would not be serious. And Smith himself had a higher opinion of Roosevelt's ability than did his aides, and he emphasized that Roosevelt's nomination would assure the party of having a candidate of integrity. Roosevelt was genuinely reluctant to run. He and Howe had decided that with the nation prosperous under a Republican president, 1928 was not going to be a Democratic year, and that their original timetable, calling for a gubernatorial run in 1932, was correct. To stay out of the reach of persuasion while the state Democratic convention was convening in Rochester, he took himself off to Warm Springs. But he could not escape the telephone, and over it, Smith persuaded him to run. The next night, he was nominated by acclamation. Moses turned to Emily Smith and said, shouting so she could hear him above the uproar, "He'll make a good candidate, but a lousy governor." The man Smith assigned to brief Roosevelt on campaign issues and draft his speeches, Bell Moskowitz's discovery, Samuel I. Rosenman, was at first not altogether enchanted with his assignment. "I had heard stories of his being something of a playboy and idler, of his weakness and ineffectiveness," he recalled. "That was the kind of man I had expected to meet." But he began almost instantly to wonder if such unfavorable views of Roosevelt were correct. The broad jaw and upthrust chin, the piercing, flashing eyes, the firm hands, they did not fit the description. He was friendly, but there was about his bearing an unspoken dignity which held off any undue familiarity. During the campaign, Rosenman watched Roosevelt pull himself laboriously to his feet as his car arrived in a town, snap his steel braces to hold his body erect, and then, chin up, cigarette holder tilted at the most nonchalant of angles, the cane on which he leaned, the only visible sign of any disability, laughingly reassure the crowd that newspaper speculation about his health was exaggerated. By the end of the campaign, Rosenman knew that the Smith camp's assessment of Roosevelt had been very wrong. But Moses had not changed his position. "I don't like him," he told Francis Perkins during this period. "I don't believe in him. I don't trust him." His comments became more vicious. Miss Perkins recalled Moses saying to her about Roosevelt, "He's a pretty poor excuse for a man. He said so to me in just those words. He's a pretty poor excuse for a man." He never actually mentioned the full extent, or what he imagined to be the full extent, of Roosevelt's disabilities, recalled another member of the Smith entourage. But he was always hinting around about it in the most vicious kind of way. Vicious. That was the only word for it. His comments took in not only Roosevelt, but his wife as well. "I wouldn't repeat what he said about Eleanor Roosevelt," another Smith aide said. "Just say he dwelt on her physical appearance and her voice, and was quite insulting." The comments got back, as comments made in political circles always seem to do, to their targets, and Roosevelt responded in kind. During the same period, he told Francis Perkins that, if he was elected, "I'm not going to have Bob Moses around, Francis, because I don't trust him. I don't like him. I don't trust him. There'll be trouble." Roosevelt's feeling for Moses, says one man who knew them both, was at least equal in intensity to Moses' feeling for Roosevelt. You can employ euphemisms to describe the electricity that was present when those two men were in the same room, he says, but if you are going to be accurate, you have to say there was real hatred there. Election Day in 1928 was November 6th. The dark forces to which Handlin referred had done their work well on the boy who had thought he could rise from the Fourth Ward to be president. Alfred E. Smith received 87 electoral votes to Herbert Hoover's 444. He even lost New York State. But Franklin Delano Roosevelt pulled 2,130,193 votes to Ottinger's 2,104,193. The man who hated Robert Moses was governor. Al Smith was bitter over the anti-Catholic prejudice that had marked the campaign. But at first, that was the only bitterness. He seemed reconciled, even relieved, to be out of politics. After 25 years in public office, he wanted to settle down with Katie and spend more time with the grandchildren he adored. After 25 years, he was still poor. The governor's salary in 1928 was only $10,000, less than that of his cabinet officers, and he was tired of that too. He wanted security in his old age and something to leave his sons. John J. Rascomb, William T. Kenney, and other friends had offered him the presidency of the Empire State Building Corporation, which was erecting New York's tallest skyscraper, at a salary of $50,000 per year. "I have had all I can stand of it. As far as running for office is concerned, that's finished," he said, and at the time he meant it. One proof was his voluntary surrender of the titular leadership of the National Democratic Party. Another was his refusal to intervene when his ally, Judge George Olvaney, was forced out as head of Tammany Hall in 1929. If Smith had intended to run for president in 1932, he would certainly have attempted to maintain control of Tammany to keep a base of electoral votes on which to build a campaign. In November 1928, as he packed up so that Roosevelt could move into the executive mansion early, and busied himself personally overseeing the installation of the ramps Roosevelt would need to move in a wheelchair around the mansion and the Capitol, Alfred E. Smith, the happy warrior, was ready to retire, still mostly happy, from politics. He certainly bore no personal animosity toward Roosevelt, and, raised in the Tammany tradition in which men were retired from active service honorably when the time for retirement came, the warriors who had held high political office becoming sachems, assured until they died of a voice in running the hall, to make room for younger men coming along, he considered, as Proskauer put it, that he and Roosevelt were members of the same team. Moreover, Smith felt that Roosevelt could be trusted to continue his programs. This was important to him. All through 1928, he had been pressing the legislature for further improvements in working conditions for women and children, for extensions of the Workmen's Compensation Act, for liberalized welfare legislation, for movement in the new field of old age pensions, and the legislature had refused to be moved on these issues. Now he wanted Roosevelt to press for them. And certainly there was every reason for him to feel that his successor would. All during the campaign, Roosevelt had pledged himself to continue Smith's policies. His typical campaign speech, the New York Herald Tribune said, began with a few words of fulsome praise for Alfred E. Smith. In the first weeks after the election, Smith was looking forward to helping the younger man get a good start in Albany. When he and Katie moved out of the executive mansion in early December, he took a suite in the DeWitt Clinton Hotel at the bottom of the little park in front of the Capitol steps so he would be available if his successor wanted to confer with him, and waited for Roosevelt to call. And there he waited. After a week had passed and Roosevelt had not contacted him, Smith swallowed his pride and telephoned the new governor. He told Roosevelt that he had assumed he would want some assistance with the details of his inaugural address and first message to the legislature, and had asked Mrs. Moskowitz to prepare a list of items that might be included. Roosevelt replied that the address and the message were almost finished, but he would be glad to show them to Smith and Mrs. Moskowitz when they were. And this, as Arthur Schlesinger puts it, he forgot to do. When the address was given, it was devoted largely to rural problems and made hardly a reference to what had gone before. When puzzled reporters asked Roosevelt whether he was going to continue the Smith policies, his evasive answer was, "Generally, for that is what we said all through the campaign." Explanations for Roosevelt's treatment of Smith vary from historian to historian, depending on whether the historian has received most of his information from intimates of Roosevelt or of Smith. Roosevelt-oriented historians say that Smith, whether or not he intended to continue to run the state after he had left office, gave that impression to Roosevelt. They cite his offer of Mrs. Moskowitz's help on the inaugural address as one way he did so. Personal feelings aside, these historians point out, Roosevelt had long viewed the governorship as a way station on the road to the White House, began planning for a 1932 presidential bid immediately after the election, and knew that if Smith changed his mind and decided to run for the presidency, he would be the man Roosevelt would have to beat. His greatest political problem in Albany, moreover, would be to get out from under the shadow of the man generally acknowledged to have been the state's greatest governor. But political considerations alone seem inadequate to account for Roosevelt's actions. One is forced to take into account another side of his complex character, the side which Raymond Moley was to call a lack of directness and sincerity, and of which Robert Sherwood was to say that at times he displayed a capacity for vindictiveness which could be described as petty. This side was frequently to be on display when Roosevelt dealt with people he had needed once, but needed no longer. Roosevelt was never at his best in getting rid of people no longer useful to him, Oscar Handlin was to write. The lack of directness and candor in his actions left a bitter impression of shiftiness, of disloyalty, and of ingratitude. And the impression was to be strengthened in his relations with Smith and Smith's people, in Moley's opinion, because Roosevelt was deeply sensitive to the fact that so many among the people who knew him believed, for one reason or another, that he lived beyond his intellectual means. Says Moley, this opinion hurt Roosevelt, but he braced his determination to overcome it. It may be added that with this effort came a not quite Christ-like tendency to beat down not only the opinion itself, but those who held it. It is not remarkable, therefore, that when he became governor, he did not avail himself of Smith's generous tender of help and advice. The mighty engine of governmental power was not destined to spare those who had once deluded themselves with a notion that Roosevelt was a weak man. Of the many books written on Roosevelt, it is significant that every one whose author was an intimate of both Roosevelt and Smith, Miss Perkins, Proskauer, Rosenman, and Jim Farley, for example, stresses this side of Roosevelt's character in attempting to explain his treatment of Smith. The final humiliation of Al Smith at the hands of the man he had asked to be his successor revolved around Robert Moses. Among the subjects Roosevelt was not anxious to discuss with Smith during the period between the election and the inauguration was that of the appointments he would make. Finally, Smith, humbling himself again, went to see Roosevelt at the Executive Mansion. Trying to make the governor-elect see that they were both members of the same team, he said, "You know, I'll always be ready to help you. I'll always come up any time you want me. I'll talk to anyone you want me to talk to. I'll negotiate with anyone about anything. I know all these people. I don't have anything to do." He said he understood that Roosevelt would want to replace most of his appointees with his own men. There were only two members of his administration who he thought were absolutely indispensable. They were Mrs. Moskowitz, whose title was Personal Secretary to the Governor, and Moses. Roosevelt, describing this conversation to Francis Perkins, said that Smith told him, You see, Mrs. Moskowitz knows all about everything. She knows all the plans. She knows all the people. She knows all the different characters and quirks that are involved in everything. She knows who can and who will do this or that. As for Moses, Roosevelt told Miss Perkins that Smith is very dependent on